horizon has no ribbon. Your gift keeps on giving. What is this I'm feeling? If you wanna leave, I'm with it. That's his business, rent to the landlord, baby. That's his business, that's his business, that's his business. Papa used to tell me it was the electric, the electric, the electric. Mama used to tell me it was so expensive, it's expensive just to live. And the money's always gone. Papa working so hard just to get paid. We make money.
Good morning. You have arrived at Listen Local, the bi-weekly webcast from your neighborhood news source, Mission Local, brought to you via BFF.fm. Yesterday, neighbors of a 59-year-old woman facing eviction held a candlelight vigil in the early morning. She wasn't there, and no eviction took place, but it marks the beginning of a tense time in that building. It's owned by a Google employee, Jack Halperin, and the tenants are now starting their second year of a legal battle to stay in the house. We'll discuss what happened in their cases so far and how it's impacted other evictions, and also why the coming weeks will be so difficult. On Tuesday of this week, the Board of Supervisors delayed a vote that would have decided between two competing ways to regulate Airbnb and other short-term rentals. Critics say the so-called home-sharing services are leading to the, quote, hotelization of neighborhoods. And city analysts agree that taking rental units off the rental market, especially affordable ones, is damaging. So why are the supervisors stalling? We'll take a closer look at that meeting in our second half. I'm Laura Buenas. I'm here with Lydia Chavez and Joe Ravano-Barros, who's one of our staff writers. Welcome, guys.
Good morning.
Hi.
How y'all doing?
Good.
Good, good. So, in 2012, Jack Halperin bought a multi-unit building on Guerrero Street for about $1.4 million, and shortly thereafter, he evicted one tenant with an owner move-in eviction and another with a relative move-in, I believe, and since then, he has been working on evicting the other four units' tenants, which include two teachers, a young boy, and a reportedly unstable 59-year-old woman. Three of the unit's tenants recently succeeded in getting their Ellis evictions quashed in court. And through a convoluted series of events involving certified mail, the tenants never got their first halves of their mandated relocation payments. Halperin has appealed that decision, starting a new round of court proceedings. Meanwhile, a fourth unit's tenant, the aforementioned 59-year-old woman, Rebecca Bowknight, was pursuing a different eviction defense, and due to her disability was unable to complete some paperwork and I think missed some appointments. She has since received a notice from the sheriff's department that she will be forcibly evicted, or could be forcibly evicted, as of 6 a.m. this Wednesday. Things didn't exactly end there. Lydia, you've talked to the sheriff's department, I believe. Can you talk about what happens now and why this is going to be kind of a tough coming few weeks?
Well, it doesn't sound... I talked with Mark Nicchio, who's a legal assistant with the sheriff's department. And it seems like the sheriff's department, first of all, they're from 6 to 12 writs of vacating your premise every week. And two people a week are probably evicted, he said. Others are delayed for different reasons. A person is a senior, they're mentally unstable, there are children involved, and the tenant hasn't made provisions, and the city sort of steps in to help. And an eviction team goes and sort of makes an analysis of the situation, and then the sheriff's department decides when to go in. What it does seem, you know, likely is that they will go in at some point. And that they will try and go in, and they will try and first hook her up with, you know, services. But eventually she will be evicted. And it does not sound like that eventually is too far out.
Okay, so this happens pretty often that people get these notices, and then they don't actually get evicted a lot of the time.
Well, they actually get, it's delayed.
It gets delayed, okay. But they do usually eventually get evicted. So essentially this woman got a notice that as of 6 a.m. on Wednesday, at any point in the next, in the future, the sheriff could come and kick her out.
That's right, unless some other legal proceeding happens.
And what do you know what those other legal proceedings could be?
Well, they could be, I guess, the tenant taking some action on her own behalf, but that seems very unlikely in this case. Mm-hmm. And
does it seem like she has a lawyer?
It doesn't. And it doesn't seem really that she... I mean, it sounds like we have all maybe known people like this in our lives, who someone who is completely functioning, who then becomes increasingly isolated. And tenants at the building said, you know, at one point... First of all, she's the longest living tenant there. She's lived there for 25 years.
Wow.
At one point, they all used to gather in different people's apartments for dinners, monthly dinners, and they never went into her apartment, but she would come to the dinners, and then eventually she no longer came to the dinners.
Thanks.
And that they often see her out in front of the apartment in the block that it's in, just sort of walking back and forth with her dog. So that, you know, she's been not the easiest person probably to help, but that is part of the mental disability.
So what's going to happen if they do come for her?
Well, if they do, you know, when...
Or
if
when.
If they had come on Wednesday morning, she wouldn't have been there.
Right.
But they do come, and they do evict, and they take things, and then I guess they... I don't, you know, within her particular case with a mentally disabled person, I would think that they would have an expert on hand.
You would think, but we don't actually know that.
But, you know, the alternatives for them and what they can offer people, because it's not like they have another house to put the person in, is a homeless shelter, you know, a mental facility. A mental facility, a homeless shelter, an SRO. It's not like the options are good. So, I mean, when Tirado, one of the teachers who has successfully fought her eviction, says, you know, I see people on the street and I think... You know, maybe that person really did have a home at one point and then became mentally and then ends up on the street. I mean, that could be the case of this woman.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's very tragic. The interesting thing also is it seems like Halperin, who is doing a lot of construction work there, is spending less time there, the tenant said. That he'll be away for months at a time. I don't know if that is because of work or something else, but it does seem that he's not in the building as often. There is a friend staying at the apartment. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's also interesting that this has gone on for so long now, and that Halperin has appealed the decision to quash his eviction in court, which means after, I think, more than a year, right? He issued the Ellis evictions in February 2014. A year later, so February of this year, there was their actual eviction date, but they were still fighting the eviction in court, so they continue to live there now. These are the three units, tenants, that are not that did not receive an eviction notice. They have been fighting their eviction with representation from the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. And, you know, were successful in that they got the eviction quashed. And that was on the basis that they never received the first half of their relocation payments, which by law, Halperin is required to pay them in order for them to move. So that was quashed. So he's now appealed that, which means more probably months-long legal procedures. And after that, if it gets defeated again, if his appeal is unsuccessful, he could try at any time again in the future to just evict them again.
Right.
So we're looking at, you know, a very long path here, and it's just, it's kind of astonishing just how lengthy this can be, and you know how much the tenants are having to take, how much Halperin is having to deal with in terms of court stuff.
Right.
You know, legal fees, I imagine, are expensive as well. Like, this is just a mess on all sides, but it seems like both sides are completely determined to see this through. And I just wonder what happens in an impasse like this. I mean, is there a procedure to follow?
There's no procedure. And I mean, unless I guess they agree to some sort of arbitration or settlement. He seems very determined. I mean, he is right on the legal, even though he's made mistakes. His lawyers have then just gone back to court and refiled and reappealed, and they seem on it, and he seems determined. You know, 6 months ago, I would have said that the tenants, I don't think, expected to get to win. I really think that they might have been kind of ready to acknowledge that they were going to have to move out of the city.
Yeah.
And I think when they won, that really gave them a lot of just like, wow.
Yeah, you know, like buoyancy.
We can really stay here maybe. And you know, I talked to one of the tenants the other day, and I actually called Alperin's lawyer and talked to him, although he wouldn't say much. But it seems like it's going to be at least 7 months before they even get a court trial again.
Right, yeah.
So,
and then they're also suing him in court, essentially for being a bad landlord, yes, allegedly.
Yeah.
So that's a whole separate case. There's just so much legal stuff going on in this one apartment. And I do think that, you know, from what I've heard from the tenants also, they're trying to set an example in a way. You know, if you stick to it and you go through all this legal process, there is a chance that you will be able to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, they've already proved that because they've outstayed their alleged, like, you know, their planned eviction date for quite a while now. And
yes,
it looks like they're there to stay a little bit longer, if not permanently.
Yes.
And we've also seen now, I think in the months following their success with quashing the eviction, I saw an article about a similar case that happened also in the Mission where the exact same defense was used. And I am not a tenant lawyer, so I have no idea if this is a totally common practice or if this is just something that's now sort of, you know, becoming a trend of sorts. I wonder. I'm curious.
Yes, it would be good to know. But we've seen a couple of other cases succeed on these sort of measures. The Curtin case on 20th and Folsom, and also the Rey de Yanez case has been delayed, and he's managed to stay there much beyond what people expected that he could stay with. But there's huge incentive on the tenants' part, because it really means if they lose, they leave the city. It's not just losing their apartment, and their lives are in the city.
Right.
And they have jobs in the city. They're here, so it's a...
But it doesn't seem inevitable to you that this will... Because if it's only technicalities that are holding up Halperin in court and he goes back to fix these technicalities, it seems just a matter of time that he'll win this case. If there's nothing really preventing him from using the LSAT...
Right, he's not going to make the same mistake twice.
Yeah, he's not going to make the same mistakes. Mm-hmm. He's going to run out of mistakes to make.
That does seem like it is. But I think there are other things could happen. I won't say exactly what, but I think other things could happen.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk for a second? I see a lot of comments and stories about this from people who say that it's totally not relevant who the owner is and whether or not, you know, who he works for. I think probably in every headline about this, we've mentioned that he's a Google employee. I mean, I have some thoughts on that, why it's relevant in terms of news, but I'll throw it over to you for a second first to kind of address that.
Well, you know, to me, that's less important, actually, then to me, this just this case fascinates me because it's about human nature and who we are as people and, you know, what kind of people we are and what kind of society we are. And that's what interests me. I mean, there are, I happen to know some other tech, you know, landlords in the Mission who are wonderful landlords. They're new landlords. They're not landlords with a lot of experience, but they've been very good to their tenants. So that, you know, to me, the more interesting thing is here you have a person who comes in who's not a landlord, who decides he's going to buy a building. He gets a very good deal on the building because the mortgage is determined, and the mortgage that he can get is determined by the fact that these people are paying lower rents, so they can't sell the building for a whole lot. And then he turns around and decides to get rid of all of them so that he can sell these places individually. And to sell the places individually, all of a sudden, a building in this market has gone from $1.4 million to probably being worth close to $7 million. So, why? I mean, why would you do that? Unless you're some just awful speculator. Usually individuals don't go to that sort of ends to push people out and to make money.
Yeah.
And it does seem relevant. I mean, this guy is a wealthy tech lawyer against tenants who are not wealthy at all, and it's just such an archetype for what's going on in San Francisco generally that those facts.
It's an archetype in the sense of, yes, you have tech moving in, and they can pay more. But I think, to me, it's just more interesting in terms of the kind of person he is.
Yeah, but also the fact that he's a tech lawyer figures into that. I think he's a wealthy person.
He could just be a wealthy person. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's also relevant to point out that he is new to being a landlord in the city. And I think to this particular story, it doesn't matter that his immediate employer is this firm. It doesn't necessarily immediately matter, you know, where he comes from or whatever. But in the broader sense, I think that people are observing sort of the bigger picture and trying to figure out, you know, who are the bad actors among the landlords? Mm-hmm. Who is it who's perpetrating all these evictions? And just because this is one example of a new tech landlord behaving arguably badly doesn't necessarily mean that they all are, but it does, you know, kind of go into the scoreboard or the roster. And we have observed landlords who have been very long-time San Francisco landlords and who may have grown up and worked here who have also behaved arguably badly and been negligent of their tenants and of their houses. But, you know, if we don't ask those questions and then answer them in the reporting, then we don't have any context, any answer to that question when it comes up in the broader sense.
Yeah, in my mind, I would have to say he's not even a landlord. He's a speculator. He's not planning to stay there and take rent from people.
And take care of his tenants. Exactly. I mean, that's what a landlord is supposed to do.
Mm. Exactly.
Yeah. And
make some money from that. You would expect that.
Yes. And we also, you know, can't really know this, and we can't know his intentions because he's never spoken to us.
Right. And I did speak to him once on the first time. Yeah, I went down.
And what did you hear?
He was standing. There were some people working outside, and I said, gee, is he there? And so they went down and got him, and he came down, and he just said, it was the only interview I've ever had with him in which he said, I'm not going to turn it into condos. But of course, he can't turn it into condos.
Right, yeah, legally he just can't. He also can't rent it again, so the only real option is...
And then he turned around and went back in. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, going to have to remain a mystery unless we hear further commentary from the man himself. But I think in the meantime, we should shift our focus to our second topic of the day, which is the so-called Airbnb legislation. So part of the reason it's so devastating to get kicked out of an apartment in San Francisco is, of course, the lack of relocation options nearby, as we mentioned. And critics of home-sharing platforms like Airbnb, which includes Supervisor David Campos, have argued that Airbnb and its ilk are contributing to the problem of no housing by taking units off the rental market. Sometimes people are even said to be evicted by landlords who simply want to turn a much higher profit by using their property as an unofficial hotel year-round. That's problematic because it means that those spaces can't be rented by permanent residents, and until recently, anyone who ran an impromptu hotel of this sort didn't pay taxes, if memory serves. They're now required to, and Airbnb has agreed to pay back taxes for prior years. But the city still needs to figure a way to prevent home-sharing profiteering. On Tuesday, two proposals for how to do this were supposed to be voted on, but Supervisor Mark Farrell instead moved to continue the two items, which means delaying a vote, until July 14th. So let's talk about these two pieces of legislation. Lydia, you wrote a whole piece about these. Before we get into what the delay means and what might have happened there, first tell us about some key differences between the pieces of legislation.
A big difference, although not that big and probably a compromise can be made really easily, is, you know, Campos is saying 60 days. You can host a place for 60 days, whether you're there or not. And Farrell is saying 120 days. So that is a difference in the number of days that you can make money off of your extra unit or your extra room or your extra couch. And the big difference is that Campos is actually requiring something of the hosting platforms to monitor this, to say that, you know, before you accept someone on your hosting platform, they have to be registered with the city. And then once they've taken up their allotted time to rent out their place, you have to remove them from the hosting platform. Farrell is saying, we'll just come up with an office of compliance using people from the planning department, taxation, and Department of Public Inspection. So there's no real compliance in Farrell's, whereas with Campos there is, and that's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. So some of the arguments at the meeting kind of revolved around how do we weed out the bad actors. You know, constituents in my district really want to use Airbnb because they're barely hanging on by the skin of their teeth because their rents are so high, so they need a way to make a little bit of extra money. And they can do that easily by renting out their homes. How do we separate out those people from the people who are just blatantly profiteering and using a unit year-round and just making enormous amounts of money, or disproportionate amounts of money, depending on how you want to see it? And it sounds like the real enforcement issue is, how do you know how often they're renting out their unit? And, you know, whether they're there or not is pretty much impossible to figure out, because I think, as Supervisor Kim suggested, there's no way to know that unless you give everybody basically some kind of tracking armband to see what their GPS location is at all times. So, yeah, it does seem like the most obvious enforcement option is to tell Airbnb, once you hit a certain number of days of renting out your registry on Airbnb, you're done for the year. You can't.
Yeah.
And so why is that, you know, why is there so much resistance to that?
Maybe you could speak to that.
I have
no
idea. I mean, I think it's probably Airbnb is pushing this resistance.
Sure, but why would they resist that?
I don't know.
Well, they're making money as well. Common sense, yeah. I mean, they're making money as well.
It's another thing for them to do.
This idea, you know, it's really, I have to say, a ludicrous idea that internet businesses somehow don't have to be regulated, that it's the Wild West, that everything is free, as if it's free on all ends. It's not free. People are paying money. People are making money.
Sure, yeah. The title,
I mean,
home
sharing.
You have
a business in San Francisco. Uh-huh. You have to, in order to get a bank account, you have to have a number from the state, and you have to give that number to the bank, and that allows you to open up an account. So you, if you're a host in San Francisco, you have to have a number from the city registry, and that, until you have that number, Airbnb shouldn't let you register.
Yeah. And right. Airbnb is not exactly a small business that can afford to do this very easily. It should not fall.
And
it should not be another task
was.
For the city to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is a programming problem.
It seems so simple.
It's not.
Well, I don't know anything about programming, so I don't know if I'd be so quick to say that. But it does seem like kind of where I wanted to go with this is that the New York, I believe, district attorney or city attorney?
The state attorney.
State attorney has subpoenaed. Airbnb's records because they're just like not going to put up with this anymore. Essentially, they're just like, look, we need this information.
Right. And
done.
When they did that, they found that 75% of units in New York City were illegal.
Ah,
and now the problem for New York is actually enforcing this rule. And they've been very slow to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to be, I think that's what Campos is also pushing for, is getting these records from Airbnb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To which, of course, the immediate argument in the Board of Supervisors meeting was, oh, but doesn't that violate privacy? And I think Mar's response to that was the privacy issue is bogus.
What New York has done is that this is metadata essentially until there's some sort of illegal transgression, and then you can go pursue the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So the privacy concerns, I think, are a lot of just hogwash and, you know, hot steam, because it doesn't seem to be a real concern here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And in this instance, in terms of the legislation on the table, there are no privacy concerns. He is also asking for quarterly reports, but again, that would be metadata.
Right,
it's not. Yeah.
Yeah, I think actually the suggestion was to redact names and addresses, identifiable names and addresses from the public records, which, you know, I guess that's one way to do it, but it seems like the metadata approach would be simpler. In any case, it involves some sort of compliance from Airbnb, which is arguably the source of this.
But what about that delay, Laura? I mean, here, the city has had since, from the day one of the legislation being passed in February, people knew that it needed to be refined.
Yes.
And everyone is working. And the mayor has had this proposal, the Mayor Farrell proposal out for quite a long time,
mm-hmm.
as Campos has had his proposal out for quite a long time. So why on the day of the debate is there a delay?
Yeah, I think, something must have happened beforehand, because it didn't seem to me, but like people were expecting that to happen. You know, of course, the usual crowd had gathered at this meeting to potentially speak at public comment and to generally support what their favorite supervisor was saying. But it seemed like maybe before the meeting there was some discussion or some word got around that things were not going to go as one or the other party wanted them to go. And,
essentially,
and then,
the Campos was going to, the legislation, that they could not block the Campos legislation.
Right.
Because the request for a delay comes from Farrell.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Either that they couldn't block it, or that they decided, you know, there's really, you know, this goes way too far for our comfort, and there's no way we're going to be able to argue it down to some place where we previously thought we could get it to, or what we really want is no restriction on days whatsoever. Or, you know, whatever. I think some modification that they were hoping to get then wasn't going to work out, and it looked like it was slipping out of control, so now they're looking for more time to kind of bend it.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's, you have to hand it for Campos for doing things that you wouldn't think. I mean, it makes them look a little like, you know, finally they pay taxes. Finally they pay back taxes. I mean, who gets to operate in any city without paying taxes? It's like, it's like, oh yes, how great, Airbnb pays taxes. It's like, of course they pay taxes. And Campos and Feinstein, who kept after Airbnb demanding the back taxes, Airbnb doesn't come up on its own and say, oh, I'm ready to pay back taxes immediately. It's like,
well, nobody's going to volunteer to pay taxes. I think that much is clear.
You don't have to pay taxes.
Yes, yeah, and it should be self-evident.
No one wants to pay taxes.
Sure, exactly.
But it's not. It shouldn't be the city having to say you have to pay back. Of course, you have to pay them.
And it shouldn't be such a grand victory.
And it shouldn't be a big argument.
Like,
sure.
Hello, what are you doing?
Exactly. Do you? Is there anything else happening in New York State that they're doing a little differently than San Francisco?
All I know is that right now they're having some success with rooting out these illegal units, but mm-hmm. it's very mild. I mean, there's like also the number of illegal units has shrunk by like 3%, but really it seems to be marginal, these effects. Mm-hmm. So I think the big question for New York is still, how do you actually enforce this law?
Mm-hmm. Then there's also the issue of Airbnb only being responsible. I heard this number being thrown around, but I haven't verified it independently, for less than half of the actual short-term rentals that occur in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, once you go after Airbnb's information, you have to go after all the other hosting platforms.
Yeah, they're all...
And this is a process that it seems like would be worth getting started on if we're going to go this direction. Yeah. And yeah, it seems like... the opposition is hoping that we will not go in that direction and not pursue that kind of enforcement at all.
Mm-hmm. No, it's fascinating to watch this play out, and it definitely is this whole, in a way, it's this whole new area. In another way, it's just businesses making money, and the government always steps in to regulate.
Well, and now it's complicated by this term sharing economy and home sharing, because it seems like people are targeting, when they say they have criticisms of home sharing and Airbnb and whatever other platform, it sounds like they're criticizing the people who are using it.
Right.
And to some extent, yes, the people who are using it will be affected, but it sounds like the bigger interest here is that of the bigger target of criticism is the platform itself.
Right.
And that's the business that is, you know, requiring...
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember. I mean, I don't think that Campos or Farrell or anyone actually on the Board of Supervisors objects to people renting out their places. I mean, and making money from it and letting that help them pay their mortgage or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, without any regulation whatsoever, it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
It's a business.
Well, we'll see how that plays out on July 14th when it comes up for the vote again. We'll see if there are any major differences. Maybe we'll be proved wrong. Maybe we'll be proved right. We'll see. In the meantime, let's move on to neighborhood notes, where each of us shares a little bit of a tidbit from around the neighborhood. I'll start. I want to plug BFF's fundraiser. If you're listening to BFF, you probably already know what I'm talking about. If you're not a regular listener and you're tuning in just for us, thanks. But also consider maybe throwing a few dollars in the direction of BFF. It's an almost entirely volunteer-run station, and they exist in this one small studio that we're sitting in now, which doesn't fit a whole lot of people or things, and it's also perpetually live. So building a new studio would allow DJs and show hosts to pre-record things, to experiment with production, and to just all around kick up the level of production value of the shows that they bring to BFF. That fundraiser is currently going on, and on Tuesday evening, Tuesday the 16th, I believe, you can go to the chapel and join in their celebratory homestretch hustle. So I hope to see you there.
Sounds great.
I have been working on this piece on art galleries, so Southern Exposure is having a new exhibit called Up in the Air by Bernie Lubel. I think starts on Saturday the 13th, and it's about airships and dirigibles and blimps and all homemade wood.
Nice.
Like, he creates it himself, and actually you can go in and help him create the exhibit. So I think that should be pretty fun.
Oh, that sounds very cool. Dance party that I probably won't be at. But if I were younger, would be at 24th and Bryant at the Galleria de la Raza. They're going to unveil their new digital mural, which is maricón, which is a derogatory term for gays in Spanish slang. And there's going to be a big dance party, and it's in celebration of, you know, SF Pride Month. So.
Great. So that's enough out of us. You've been listening to Listen Local, brought to you by the staff of Mission Local via BFF.fm. Thanks for listening.